Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, September 16th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. In 1959, the then Premier of Saskatchewan, Thomas Douglas, envisioned a universal prepaid and publicly administered healthcare system, the first of its kind in North America. This plan for Saskatchewan prompted the federal government to initiate a national strategy to subsidize socialized medicine and support provinces in the shift to a universal system. He's recognized as the father of Medicare and the one to thank for our universal healthcare system as we know it in Canada today. But is this system in trouble? This is not a conversation which is new to Rabble Radio. In May, Rabble contributor Doreen Nickel sat down with Natalie Mara, the executive director of the Ontario Health Coalition, to talk about the privatization of long-term care homes in Ontario. Nickel spoke to Sarah Jama, the co-founder of the Disability Justice Network of Ontario, later that month to talk about the importance of accessible healthcare services in regard to those who are differently abled. This week, we continue the conversation by sharing an interview from the first episode of the newest season of Courage, My Friends. In this interview, host Resh Badu speaks with J.P. Hornick, the president of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union, and palliative care physician and health justice activist Dr. Naheed Dasani. The three discuss the current crisis facing public health care in Ontario. Avid listeners of the show are familiar with the Courage My Friends podcast series, but for those of you who are new to Rabble Radio, allow me to elaborate. Courage My Friends is a podcast series presented by Rabble.ca and the Tommy Douglas Institute at George Brown College, with the support of the Douglas Coldwell Leighton Foundation. You can catch the full series of Courage My Friends on our sister podcast, Needs No Introduction. Today's interview comes from the first episode of the newest season of Courage My Friends. Here is a snippet from that interview. Take a listen.
So it's ironic, perhaps bittersweet, that in the opening to this season's Courage My Friends podcast, named for the famous quote by Tommy Douglas, who is the father of universal healthcare in Canada, we're talking about the threat of healthcare privatization. So to get us started, JP, why is universal healthcare so important to the common good?
Well, I've been saying for a long time now that public healthcare and public education are the pillars, I think, of any strong democratic society. I mean, these are literally the spaces that we have created collectively to care for one another, to connect with one another. And we do so without an eye toward profit or power over, but rather literally a foundation of care. Citizens who are healthy, who are educated, these are the ones who can actively participate in civil society. This is where we make strong communities. This is how we demonstrate that we are in it together in a literal, quite a visceral way. So I think keeping profit out of healthcare is an essential feature of building a society that works for all rather than a privileged few.
Indeed. And now, we're certainly not the only country to have universal health care. Nevertheless, universal health care has been inscribed into the national identity as a Canadian value. As a healthcare worker and a health justice activist, Naheed, what does universal health care mean to you?
You know, I think it's important to recognize that while here in Canada, we enjoy our public healthcare system, we have a healthcare system that's publicly funded, but privately delivered. And while we pride ourselves on that public healthcare system aspect, what's really coming to light is that there has been a push towards privatization. And when I work on the front lines, I cannot tell you how important public healthcare is. It allows for people to get access to care without paying, although it comes from taxes, quote unquote. People who cannot afford or would not normally afford healthcare can gain access. People who are marginalized are able to gain access through bulk purchasing power and our collective force, we're able to actually bargain for cheaper prices. We are in a position as a society to care for each other. And that collective good is important. I mean, at the end of the day, never forget that the goal of privatized healthcare is to provide profits for shareholders. Meanwhile, the goal of public healthcare is to provide healthcare for people. And I think at its core, that's what this is all about. People matter more than profits.
Okay. And this very much goes within your purview of health justice as a health justice activist. And just so that we can understand a bit more of what that is, Naheed, what is health justice?
So in my day-to-day work, I work as a palliative care physician, and I provide healthcare for people who experience structural vulnerabilities like poverty and homelessness. And this puts me on the front lines of healthcare, particularly for people who suffer from health disparities and inequities, even though we have a quote unquote universal healthcare system. When I think of health justice, I think of how we are making the leap from equality to equity to justice. Equality is when we give people the same things to be happy and healthy. And that's kind of what our Canadian healthcare system technically offers currently. And I think we do an okay job of that, actually. Where we sometimes don't really hit the mark is with equity. In an equity-based healthcare system, people would get what they need to be happy and healthy. And moving it further, in a health system that's based on justice, people would get the resources they need to make their own decisions about what they need, when they want, how they want, where they want it. And so in conversations like this, we're up and striving for health justice. We have a long, long way to go. And publicly funded healthcare is a core pillar to a health system that's really founded and anchored in justice.
Okay. And JP, could you speak a bit more to the union perspective?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for OPSU CEFPO, we represent over 25,000 members in the hospital professional divisions who work in 250 different types of jobs in 80 hospitals across the province. When I think about healthcare in the union perspective, it's really thinking about it beyond just a single slice of healthcare. We all think of, you know, understandably, nurses and doctors, but these other folks are working in the medical lab. There's technologists as technicians, radiation technologists, respiratory therapists, phlebotomists, perfusionists, pharmacists, pharmacy techs, paramedics. We have ambulance dispatchers in the broadest possible spectrum, social work, physiotherapy. We have 15,000 members who are home care workers, personal support workers. When I think about labor and healthcare, I'm thinking about it in terms of healthcare as a wraparound service for each and every patient in Ontario, but also their families, their communities, their friends. So labor in healthcare is looking at fighting off privatization and the profit motive in ways that are often unseen and in ways that are often unaccounted for, but have direct and immediate impact in people's lives. So, for example, without accurate and timely medical testing, doctors can't perform their duties and patients don't get the care that they need. When we're looking about the crisis in long-term care, when we look about the privatization of things like Canadian Blood Services, where we just entered into an agreement with Grifols, which is a private firm out of Spain, about plasma, these are how we start to hive off and chip away at the foundation of public healthcare funding, right? When we are looking at labor, we have to look at it as a bulwark against increased privatization within healthcare, which allows us to protect Ontarians going forward and protect what we consider to be this really sacred sense of ourselves. The low funding that's happening in healthcare. I mean, Ontario funds its public hospitals at the lowest rate of any province in Canada, and we have the fewest hospital beds per person. But we also have, as a result, an ongoing staffing shortage in every area of frontline and back of house services that actually sustain public healthcare. These are the folks that, even though unseen often, are the ones that provide those key services that allow us to run well. So when you have a premier who talks solely about beds, who talks solely about one aspect of the sector, it allows them to ignore and hive off those parts of healthcare that are essential cradle to grave patient care and that actually are what allow us to move forward in ways that make sure that people are taken care of where they are rather than based on their income, based on their social location, right? We have to fight hard to protect what we have, but also to build back what we used to have. And unions are the front line of that because of the vast array of healthcare workers that we represent.
Right. And it is such, as you say, such a complex network of all of these different professions and sectors that make up our healthcare framework. And healthcare, again, as both of you have pointed out, is such a fundamental part of our security, of our social security, every kind of security within our society.
Can I add one little thing to this? Sure. When I'm talking about this broad healthcare network, I think there's also a broad kind of progressive movement network that needs to be formed in order to protect these services too. So when I think about the labor movement plus progressive political parties plus members of the broader community, we all need to work together to demand an end to this agenda of privatization. We need to work together. And I think this is boots on the ground, bodies in the street, toward increased funding and progress and moving toward a comprehensive public healthcare system that includes mental health, dental health, all forms of healthcare, right? We need to really look at where do we want to be and how can we work together to get there? And labor is a key part of that.
Absolutely. And in order to understand what we're in danger of losing, I want to go back a bit to really understand what it is that we're trying to protect. Nahid, you've already talked about how we pay for universal healthcare out of the public purse for the public good. But could you say a bit more about how universal healthcare actually works?
Yeah, so I think this social safety net, this social protection, which is our public healthcare system, doesn't come out of thin air. It is something that is created through a collective will, collective solidarity, and collective good to paying in towards a public system through our public tax dollars. And this money is obviously collected, particularly at the federal level, and through healthcare transfers, this money is transferred to the provincial level. And in jurisdictions across Canada, the way the money is spent is typically up to the jurisdictions in each province and how they choose to allot that money, so long as the Canadian Health Act is followed, which is a national agreement that all the provinces agree to, ensuring that people don't have to pay for their healthcare. We have a publicly funded healthcare system, but it's privately delivered. And in many instances in the provinces, that public money is then given to private entities to deliver the care. In most cases, those entities are not for profit, but in some cases, they are for profit. And I think that's where some people may get confused. You know, I have many friends and people say to me, but when I present my OHIP card, for example, here in Ontario, or my health card, healthcare is quote unquote free to me. But that doesn't mean that there isn't the entity of private healthcare in the background. It's always been there to some degree. I think why we're having this conversation today is because we're hearing that our provincial governments are essentially talking about expanding the private for-profit entity that was there before. And so, yes, you can have the expansion of private for-profit healthcare in a public healthcare system, which ultimately, as JP has so well articulated, can erode the public healthcare system. It's not coming out in direct words. It's not being said directly. We're often hearing code words like quote unquote innovation being used, but that often is just a code word for further privatization.
Absolutely. And JP, did you want to add on in terms of how universal healthcare works or is supposed to work?
I think that Nahid really hits it on the head. Like these code words that are being used, such as innovation. I mean, the irony is that the greatest innovations in society have come from the public sector when they're funded. And what we have is a deliberate attempt to starve the system, or that tactic called starving the beast, so that private options start to look more and more attractive and like the only way out of what is a deliberately created funding crisis. It would be one thing if Ford's, I'm just going to build all these private hospitals, except they're banned in Ontario, as they have been since the 70s. We only have three of them. They were grandfathered in. But the ban on private hospitals is important because when you introduce the profit motive, you're not improving capacity. And whenever you expand privatization in healthcare, you're siphoning valuable resources away from the public system, and you're looking at putting those resources into the pockets of large for-profit companies and corporations. So healthcare privatization, or the expansion of privatization in the public system is, as Naeed said, it's false to say you just present your OHIP card and everything's free, because there are also these ancillary fees that get introduced in these private clinics, that get introduced in these private services. So things don't remain free. What happens is you create over time a tiering of the healthcare system. So those with means and resources have access to better healthcare than those without. It simply means that we create a society that is dystopian. Your value as a human being is linked to your ability to produce or retain wealth. And that is not a society that I think that any Ontarian wants to live in.
Over the last 2 years of the pandemic, we've seen incredible strain that was put onto healthcare systems. And in the last couple of months, there have been these dire warnings that public healthcare, at least in Ontario, may be on the verge of collapse. So, Naeed, are we on the verge of collapse? And what does that right now look like to you?
You're absolutely right to talk about COVID. Undoubtedly, I think we all know COVID had a major impact on our society, but certainly our healthcare system, and has kind of left a real trauma that has been sustained, where the healthcare system is in a state of shock. And that state of shock continues. Health workers face moral injury, compassion fatigue, burnout. And all the while, our governments have made decisions around policy that have only made the situations worse when it comes to the pandemic, such as eliminating COVID protections, more recently removing the 5-day mandatory isolation rules for COVID, which will undoubtedly have an impact on our volumes and wait times in hospitals as we go into the fall and winter months. And one of the things that has come out of this is poor staffing and understaffing, because staff are feeling burnt out, because our systems don't pay staff enough. In the meantime, we've seen private entities, private nursing agencies, their original purpose was to provide coverage and fill holes when publicly funded nurses in hospitals weren't available. What we've seen is actually nurses, in many cases, who are feeling burnt out and underpaid and undervalued from the public healthcare system, and I totally get where they're coming from, are moving towards the private nursing agencies where they are sometimes paid double. And so what you're seeing in some hospital floors across the province is you'll have a nurse who's getting paid $120 an hour by a private agency working alongside a public nurse who's being paid $60 an hour. So what do you think is going to happen? We're seeing nurses leaving the profession in droves, moving towards the private entity. The private agencies are lining their pockets with profit. And this is all public dollars that is doing this. It's actually an inefficient use of public dollars that is actually just creating profits for a third party. To actually fix this, just fund public healthcare, pay nurses what they deserve, give them their benefits, give them their overtime pay, and give them paid sick days. I think we'd be in a better place. This is a really good case study of how private healthcare is impacting our healthcare system that's in the state of shock due to COVID-19. You can see this becoming more and more common, and it needs to stop.
So we're seeing a major siphoning from the public sector, the public purse, into the private sector. As you say, nurses are a great example of bleeding from our public institutions into these private clinics and private practices. JP, could you come in on this and talk about what has been happening in terms of labor policy, certainly during COVID, but also from before?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just nursing. That level of burnout, compassion fatigue, exhaustion, lures into the private clinics. These are things that are affecting all of the healthcare workers that I was talking about earlier. And then you look at what's happening to the paramedics and the dispatchers on the front lines in terms of even getting patients into the system, and the way in which they're faced with emergency rooms that are shut down, right? Closing in smaller communities and getting closer and closer to major urban centers too, because it's a deliberate strategy of starving the system of resources. I mean, it's clear with Ford and the Conservative government in Ontario that they're pursuing this policy of increased health privatization. But he's also leading this push among provincial premiers to further this healthcare privatization agenda nationally. And it's building on this willingness among governments, and it's not limited to Conservative governments. There were past Ontario provincial governments who did this, to look to privatization to reduce the cost to government, transfer the cost to citizens, and introduce opportunities for private healthcare providers, their friends, to profit. So you've got a kind of perfect storm that COVID maximized a crisis that was already existing. Decreased funding, unanticipated service costs, then you throw in on top of that supply chain issues, particularly around PPE, but also tools and resources. And then you've got an ongoing problem with recruitment and retention of staff. These are the new realities that hospitals have to tackle at the same time trying to care for patients. And they're not allowed to carry deficits. So in the absence of additional funding, it means that the choices that hospitals regularly resort to are service cuts in order to try and balance budgets. But all this comes back to a very simple thing. It is a failure to adequately fund healthcare, both before and during the pandemic. And then the deterioration of the public system that results is used as an excuse in itself for increased privatization as an answer to a quote unquote, as you both said, broken system. That's the rationale we're faced with, promoted by Doug Ford, by the health minister, Sylvia Jones, by their communications guru, Nick Cavallis. Yeah, and they're going to look at all options and they're going to fix healthcare, except the options they're not looking at are the ones that are the answer. Adequate funding and removing the profit motive. These are distinct and deliberate choices. This government had no mandate for privatization, and they have never tested this outside of post-election victory. But increasing privatization as a way to solve a crisis in staffing, a crisis in funding, it is foolish, it is dangerous, and it is disingenuous. Disguising it as innovation, it doesn't respect or value the expertise, the dedication of those healthcare workers who have been working throughout the pandemic to provide this care with fewer and fewer resources, but who are involved in the entire arc of patient care. And that's what is gross.
That was a small portion of the first episode of the third season of the Courage My Friends podcast series on Needs No Introduction. Be sure to queue up the full episode of that show right after this one. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to Rabble's editor, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on the site, Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg reflects on Pierre Poilievre's recent election as leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. On the night of his victory as Conservative leader, Poilievre presented a softer version of himself than what Canadians have come to identify him with. But Canadians should not gloss over the politician he has shown himself to be in the past, Nirenberg argues, writing, quote, "If media observers and commentators let him get away with it, Poilievre will have accomplished an identity quick change more dramatic than that of Clark Kent to Superman," end quote. He continues, quote, "Those of us who report on politics should not let Poilievre succeed. We have a duty to tell the whole truth about the new leader of the opposition," end quote. Also in Canadian politics, Stephen Wentzel reports on legislative goals that the federal NDP have been able to attain. Ahead of the fall session of Parliament, the federal NDP called on the Liberal government to double the goods and services tax credit, while also increasing the Canada Child and the Canadian Housing Benefit programs. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau did just that. On the final day of the Liberal caucus retreat, the Prime Minister announced his party's intention to introduce several pieces of legislation that would address the rising cost of living, including doubling the goods and services tax credit for 6 months. The Liberals also announced a plan to provide a Canada dental benefit to children under 12 who do not have access to dental insurance, and to provide a one-time top-up to the Canada Housing Benefit to deliver $500 to 1.1 million Canadian renters who are struggling with the cost of housing. In labor news, Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga shares a report by l'Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique, which outlines how higher interest rates are not the solution to avoid a recession. Investing in the public sector is. For unions like the Public Service Alliance of Canada, or PSAC, this report reinforces their demands for higher wages for public service workers. PSAC National President Chris Aylward said that while wages have stagnated, companies are posting record profits. Instead of putting inflation on the backs of workers, the report says it is important to hold corporations accountable as they use high levels of inflation to up prices and bring in profits. Aylward said that putting this money into compensation for workers will ensure that the money goes back into the economy instead of the pockets of a wealthy few. Finally, Off the Hill is back next week. Join panelists MP Leigh Gazan, Georgina Lazor, and Brianne Lavallee-Heckert and co-hosts Robin Brown and Libby Davies as they deconstruct truth and reconciliation. On Thursday, September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, join our panel via Zoom and engage with our panelists as they discuss how Indigenous peoples are exercising sovereignty every day, the tangible ways settlers can support Indigenous peoples in their communities, and what action must be taken at the federal and provincial levels for meaningful change. Listeners can find a link to register for this event for free in the show notes of this week's episode of the show. To those of you tuning in on radio, you can find the link to this event and the full versions of all the stories mentioned today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. Finally, our Rabble Rousers to Watch series is back. We're kicking off this year's Rabble Rousers by introducing you to Angela Davidson, also known as Rainbow Eyes. She's a land defender for one of the last old-growth forests on Turtle Island, near Fairy Creek and British Columbia. She speaks with us about how her love for the land keeps her going.
Gaila Kesla, Nuku Am Rainbow Eyes. I am a member of the Dnakdaw Awitlala First Nation, and our traditional territory is Knight Inlet. And we are here at our village on Harbledown Island, Tazisnukume. I am an Indigenous land defender. I felt the call of the forest and I went to Fairy Creek and stood for the last of the old growth trees on Turtle Island. And from Fairy Creek, I went into the Green Party and was asked to be the deputy leader, Uma Anise. And we are working towards changing the path we're on, listening to our hearts and really making a change, shaking things up. I'm so honored to have been named a Rebel Rouser of 2022 to watch. So thank you to everybody that voted. It's going to be a fun time every year. Time is going faster. Things are changing. If you would like to read more about my interview, you can go to rebel.ca to see more of the interview. May we be led by spirit and our hearts on this path and this work that we have to do. Gaila Kesla.
Find more information about the Rabble Rousers to Watch series on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nierenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, of course, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.